It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. There's a lot to talk about. A Patch Tuesday recap coming up. NVIDIA gets hacked, and the hackers get a lot of data out of them. We'll talk about a UEFI firmware flaw and the patch that's being put out. And then a proposal from the European Union that's just quacked. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 862, recorded Tuesday, March 15th, 2022. Quacks on or quacks off? Security Now is brought to you by Collide. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/twit to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. And by Thinxt Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter for 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by New Relic. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does. And you can get access to the whole New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free every month forever. No credit card required when you sign up at newrelic.com/security now. It's time for Security Now. Yay! I look forward to this all week. Our man of the hour, Mr. Steve Gibson. Why are you laughing? It's true.
Leo, you look forward to a vacation all week.
Well, I do that also. But no, this is easily the most informative show on the network. I mean, if you want to know what's going on in security, you know, which is really the tip of the spear for alt computing these days, you got to listen to the show.
I've thought about that. Like, it was 17 and a half years ago that you said, hey, you want to do a podcast about security? And, you know, and back then it was like, yeah, oh, well, okay, what's a podcast? But also...
and what's security?
No, I didn't know that. We'd, like, have stuff to talk about for 17 and a half years.
Yeah.
And you know, actually, some of the topics this week were from last week because I wanted to stay focused on the, you know, the consequences of what is going on in Russia with cybersecurity, and I've got a few things that couldn't fit in this week, which we'll be talking about next week. So yes, our cup runneth over with security problems. So this is episode 862 for the middle of March, and I'm looking forward to next week because that's going to be 3/22/22, but that's next week. This is 3/15/22. And of course, we missed Pi Day.
The day after Pi Day.
3.14. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So this one, I titled it Q Wax On or Q Wax Off. And those old timers among us will know about wax on, wax off. We're going to briefly touch on last week's Patch Tuesday, both for Windows and Android, which, of course, are the world's two most used operating systems, one for desktop, one for mobile. We look at a recent emergency update that Firefox received and also the need to keep an eye out for upcoming UEFI firmware updates for our various machines. A research firm plowed into a widely used SDK used by many firms, I'll enumerate them later, to develop their own custom UEFI firmware. And as we've seen before, you know, you make a mistake in the like the example code, everybody just copies it. So anyway, we got a lot of copy problems which need to get patched. But the point is that it really does undermine the guarantees that UEFI is here to provide, to keeping things from getting into, from crawling into our operating systems before they've had a chance to get booted. Also, NVIDIA has suffered a huge and quite embarrassing network breach with some consequences for them. Proton Mail handled, I think, their Russian customers correctly. So I just wanted to give them some props. But Tutanota did also. It's actually even better. The Linux kernel has been seeing some challenging times recently. So we're going to talk about that. And Russia has decided to start signing their own website certificates. And this is one of those, what could possibly go wrong? Research was also just published to put some numbers to my constant WordPress grumbling about add-ons, the lack of security in their add-ons. We now know exactly just how bad. And I guess, you know, if I could encourage people to just use the root WordPress install and like try not to embellish it with all the add-ons, that would be the takeaway from that. And finally, the European Union legislators who brought us the GDPR and mandatory website cookie notifications are at it again. With QAX. So we'll be talking about that. And we do have a fun picture of the week from one of our listeners.
And as you say, QAX on, QAX off.
Or QAX off. What could they have done now?
I'm trying to find it, but I remember seeing on Reddit, somebody wrote an app that ran in UEFI. So I think it was Wordle or something. So you, I mean, because there's, I guess UEFI, there's enough space in there. You can put an app in there. And yeah. So you boot your computer to Wordle, apparently, I guess. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but, you know.
Hopefully you can then exit.
Yes,
and go back to your regularly scheduled OS.
I'm presuming there's a menu, I would hope. Our show today brought to you by a company new to you, but I think our listeners might have heard of. If not, I'm glad to introduce you to Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E, Collide. It's a new take on endpoint management. The reason I love it, and I've been really watching them with interest, is because if you, and you know this if you're in IT, and in this modern BYOD world, you've got users with their own devices, their own endpoints, their own laptops, and they're doing their own thing, and they really, it's a little hard for IT. Sometimes you have the choice of coming off as a, you know, just like a the Gestapo coming in here saying, no, don't, you can't, you know, gluing the USB ports with crazy glue and stuff like that. Or you like the easygoing nice guy that everybody likes, except that your network is full of holes. There's a middle way to do this, and it's Collide, and it's so nice. And this is in contrast to, you know, the old school MDM tools, locking down, you know, people's devices without even, you know, talking to them or thinking about what their needs are. Or even educating them. Collide's really about education. It's built by security practitioners, people like you, who in the past saw how hated MDM was, how disruptive it was for their end users, often frustrating them so much that they would do the worst thing possible. They'd switch to their personal devices. And then, you know, there's no protection at all, and they wouldn't tell anyone. Really not a good solution. Collide is very different. Instead of locking down a device, and I've seen some examples of this lately, it's so cool. Collide takes a user-focused approach. So let's say somebody turns off two-factor on one of your company devices. You can actually communicate them. Collide does this through Slack. I've seen the Slack messages that say, hey, I see you just turned off two-factor. This is all automated. You know, there's a reason we turn it on, blah, blah, blah. Maybe this will make it easier for you. After Collide set up, device security turns from that, you know, black and white thing to a dynamic conversation that starts with the end user installing the agent, the Collide agent, on their own. So they get buy-in right from the beginning. Through a guided process, it happens right inside their first Slack message. So you're onboarding a new employee or you're setting up Collide for the first time. They get a Slack message. Hey, welcome. Great to have you on the team. Now, let's take some steps to protect you, and you walk through it. From there, Collide will regularly send employees recommendations anytime the device is in an insecure state. Things like, you know, the screen lock not being set up properly. So, you know, so that you walk away from your computer and people can still use it. To more complicated, maybe even more nuanced issues, like asking people to secure two-factor backup codes that just happen to be sitting in the download folder in plain text. And because it's talking directly to employees, Collide is educating them about the company's policies and how to keep their devices secure using real examples, not theoretical scenarios. It's brilliant. It works on Linux, Mac, and Windows devices. It's cross-platform. It's real endpoint management, but it puts users first. If you're using Slack, you've got to have Collide. It's just a great way to get all of your users on the same team, protecting the company, protecting the network, protecting themselves. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/twit to learn more. You can activate a free 14-day trial right now, no credit card required. I think everybody I've talked to who uses Collide, and I've seen lots of examples online now, just loves it, and the users love it. And the most important thing, they do it. They protect their systems. They protect you. Because they're part of the team. K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/twit. Give it a try right now. This is the right way to do it. Collide.com/twit. Picture of the week time, Mr. G.
So, okay. This is a one-off or a one-of-a-kind. One of our listeners was inspired by the question that I answered the other day about how one would detect a BGP hijack where an illicit cert was obtained on the fly immediately after the hijack in order to impersonate a website. Excuse me. And of course, the way is, as I said, to check the certificate's fingerprint, because the fingerprint is something that cannot be copied. It cannot be duplicated by someone who's spoofing it. So a fraudulent certificate with the same domain name for, you know, affecting the same site would have a different fingerprint. So this enterprising individual took the current certificate fingerprints of his most important sites and created a label like for a coffee mug. So we have a coffee mug, a nice white ceramic coffee mug, around which is wrapped this label. And the headline says, "Honey, you've left thumbprints all over my cup." And so he's got the certificate thumbprint for the Bank of Tampa. Where do you imagine he lives? Fidelity Investments, TD Ameritrade, PNC Financial Services, Synchrony Financial, the Bank of America, MasterCard, and as a nod to me, Gibson Research Corporation.
I love it.
And as I was looking at it, I was thinking, ooh, August 25th, 22 is when my cert expires. Of course, notice that nobody's that's good to know. Nobody's cert is expiring long from now. And of course, we know why, because they only get
a
year's life
anymore. Yeah.
Consequently, yeah. So everybody's 22 and 23. But anyway, I just thought this was a kick because, if you were going to the site and you were concerned that maybe you were not at the right place, you could just pick up your coffee cup, check the, use it as a reference for the proper thumbprint for the certificate, and then, baby, you're talking to the right people.
That's pretty funny. That's great. I never do the whole number, but I look at the first four and the last four, and if they match, I figure good enough.
Yeah. It is a hash, and so with any hash, the chances of, if the first four and the last four, that's going to be on the order of 32 bits, so that's one in 4.3 billion chance it's good enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had Patch Tuesday last Tuesday, and the world's dominant and increasingly rudderless desktop operating system, Windows, received fixes. Boy, I tell you, Leo, listening to Paul and Mary Jo, it's just like, well, it's called Windows Weekly, and that's W-E-A-K-L-Y.
It's kind of sad because if you have a show called Windows Weekly, you have to use Windows.
But yeah.
You get the feeling that maybe they're thinking, I wish I didn't have to use Windows.
Well, it is Mary Jo's world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's really her thing.
She has
But you really see Paul
groaning. Well, you too. I mean, you have to because SpinRite is a Windows product.
Yeah.
And so you have to use Windows. But boy, Linux just looks better and better. As Microsoft keeps making these mistakes. And
Leo, this is not in the news today for me, but they're now experimenting with adding ads.
Yeah, in Explorer.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that. It was just like, what? Stop. What? You don't make enough money? Is that it? Is that the problem, Microsoft?
I know. And I just, you know, I'm talking to you on a brand new Win 10 setup. And, you know, I had to remove Candy Crush Soda Saga.
Oh, yeah.
It's what?
Why is
this
that
is
on
in
there?
My start menu.
Yeah.
What is wrong with these people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. They fixed 71. Yes. So I was just thinking the same thing. I was thinking, you know, I mean, if anyone should be moving to Linux, it's I. I should be moving to Linux. But I do have many things that are Windows only. And, you know, for example, the next development platform I'll be switching to for SpinRite 7, Spinner will be running on a little custom 32-bit real-time operating system in order to get dual boot over UEFI and BIOS so that it can run either way. Well, it supports remote debugging, which is the only way to debug, especially on a little turnkey RTOS. You know, it's not going to have a full desktop environment, so I'll need to be reaching over to that machine to and debugging on a separate machine. That's Visual Studio. That's what it supports. It doesn't support other, you know, Linux-hosted environments. It's Visual Studio on Windows specifically.
Well, yeah, and so, you couldn't do a – if you're going to do a security show, you have to be on the insecure operating system so you can talk about it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can secure yourself. You know, you can get rid of Candy Crush Soda.
Oh, it's not the security that I'm worried about. I'm running on Windows 7. It's security's not a problem. It's just the annoying things they do.
Yeah.
And you know, Paul was complaining that he'd been writing a book for several years. His Windows had been watching him writing this book. Yet when he searches, he uses the search for the book's title, trying to find some documents relative to it that are like named that, he gets Bing results from the web. It's like, what? It was like some steakhouse. It's like, he was writing about Longhorn.
Longhorn
he was
Steakhouse.
Longhorn
yes.
Steakhouse
That's
results.
Right.
It's like, hey, Windows, there's files named Longhorn right in front of you. That's what I'm trying to have you help me find. No. How would you like your steak? Rare? Medium rare? Anyway, it's so, yes, not for security, but we're going to talk about security eventually here. Last week, Windows fixed 71 known flaws, three of which had been publicly disclosed, none which were exploited. But, of course, Microsoft calls these 0 days because someone surprised them about them. Two of the three did have publicly disclosed exploits and their remote code execution. So, again, you know, the advice is always going to be update as soon as you can. 29 of them were remote code execution. 29 of the 71 were RCEs. 25 elevation of privileges. 6 information disclosures, 4 denial of services, meaning that you can crash something and then it won't serve you. And then 3 each, security feature bypass, which is so generic it's annoying. Security feature bypass, gee. isn't that everything? Anyway, and then we have spoofing vulnerabilities, 3 of those. On top of that, we did have 21 problems identified and fixed in Microsoft's Chromium-based Edge browser. And I always kind of wonder, because we're not told, if those are things Microsoft did to edgeify it, or if those are in the Chromium core and they're just, you know, fixed because everybody who uses Chromium got those 21 things fixed. It's not clear from what Microsoft is saying. So anyway, I trust everybody has patched their Windows and gone through their update cycle. Last time it happened for me, I had to switch computers because it stopped being fast enough to run Zoom.
I'm liking this one, by the way. The picture is really good. Are you using the same camera or?
Everything's the same.
Yeah,
same,
it looks really good.
Yeah.
It's a higher
quality
image.
I could even see that the image quality is higher and the refresh rate is better. So,
it was bogging, that's all. It was just
I'm sure it
old
was.
Machine, too slow.
I'm sure. Okay, also, as I said, Android. The most severe issues fixed there was a critical security vulnerability in Android's system component that could lead to remote code execution with no additional privileges needed and no user interaction. So, you know, those are the things that like the people who are trying to get into other people's phones in targeted attacks are trying to use. And of course, Android is the majority mobile platform on the globe. So update Android also, as always. Just over a week ago, my Firefox browser jumped to update and restart itself. Like, you know, it just runs statically over on my left-hand screen all the time. And it's sort of my reference browser. And so it's rare that I see it say, like, you know, waving at me, "Hey, Gibson, restart me." And so I did. And that was to eliminate a pair of high-impact zero-day vulnerabilities, both of which it said were being, Mozilla said, were seen actively exploited in the wild. And that's a little bit of a rare thing for Firefox, you know, because it's a little bit of a rare browser, you know, increasingly rare these days. Everybody's kind of gone Chromiumized, but bless their hearts, not Mozilla. So, there were two CVEs issued for these 2 zero-days. I mean, these were like real 0 days, right? They were found being actively exploited, 2022, 26485 and 486. They're both, once again, use after free flaws impacting the extensible style extensible style sheet language transfer. Oh, Leo, speaking of hard to say, wait till we get to the Russian Kremlin gremlins. There's a tongue twister.
Oh, boy.
The style sheet language transformations, XSLT, parameter processing, and the web GPU, easily said, inter-process communication, the IPC framework. This XSLT is an XML-based language used for the conversion of XML documents into web pages or PDF docs, which Firefox can do. And this web GPU is the emerging standard that's expected to supplant the current WebGL JavaScript graphics library. Both of those had problems. In the case of this XSLT, it was found that the removal of an XSLT parameter during processing could lead to an exploitable use after free flaw. And the problem is, this could be done remotely. And as for this use after free, as is often the case, we were talking about this recently with dynamic memory management, a reference count is kept by the memory management system on behalf of the programmer so that they don't need to worry about it. And, you know, so that, you know, that frees the programmer from needing to do any kind of reference counting manually. And it's a convenience that the so-called garbage collection is done in the background without the programmer needing to bother. But the only way the system knows it's safe to release and free an object that had been allocated is if and when that object's reference count drops back to zero. So the, you know, the first time it's the first instance of a reference, or actually every instance of a reference increments the reference count. And so once there are no more references in context, the garbage collector says, "Oh, okay, nobody else is using this. I'm going to let it go." The problem is it's cool, but it's one of those inherently brittle technologies. You know, it's great when everything works exactly right, but mistakes are very difficult to spot. And normally it's the kind of thing that needs to be seen happening, which is why these problems generically, these use after free problems, keep recurring. And I guess if our listeners wanted to explain the trouble to some non-techie, they could say that use after free bugs, which can sometimes be exploited to corrupt data and execute an attacker's code arise from a confusion over which part of a program is responsible for freeing the memory. So, you know, that's sort of that's in a nutshell, that's the problem. And again, modern languages doing more for their programmers behind the scenes, but when they make little mistakes, they can be leveraged. So the other use after free glitch, because these were both that, was caused by an error when processing messages in the web GPU's inter-process communication framework. A remote attacker could trick their victim into opening a specially crafted web page, trigger this use after free error, and execute arbitrary code on the victim's system. And you know, as I mentioned, this XSLT vulnerability was exploitable in the same way. Just open the wrong web page and blammo. So last week, you would have wanted to be at Firefox 97.0.2, which is what it updated me to. But just now when I checked, it wanted me to restart, which I did, which moved me from 98 to 98.0.1 on the desktop. So you might want to check if you're using Firefox to make sure that you're current. Again, almost certainly targeted attacks. Remember the so-called watering hole attacks where something is done to lure a targeted victim to a website in order to get them compromised. So sort of a variation on phishing, but thus called a watering hole, right? So anyway, Firefox. We've talked a lot about the surprisingly daunting challenge of booting a computer while maintaining true, provable security. But this really should not be that surprising. When you think about it, the reason computers have been such an incredible breakthrough and boon for mankind is that they are so flexible. You know, it's a machine that follows instructions. The trouble arises because there's no way for it to know whose instructions it's following. It doesn't care. Its limitless vulnerability arises from its incredible flexibility. And in security, we have this concept of a chain of trust, where that chain is anchored by a root of trust. And this applies to booting up an operating system. If the operating system is signed by its publisher, any single bit that's changed will break the signature, which is just a signed hash. So the theory is the system's firmware simply needs to load the code that's been signed and then verify the operating system's cryptographically secure signature before it turns control over to it. Doing that will prevent anyone from modifying the operating system's code. You know, not one bit can be changed because the code gets hashed and signed, and a bit will completely change the hash, which, Leo, is why you and I only check the first four digits, the first and last four digits. It's like impossible for them, like majority of them, to be changed. In fact, we know if you change one bit, on average, half of the bits in the hash will be changed. So thus our strategy. Anyway, so the concept is good, but the question is, if the UEFI is performing that work, who's making sure that it's doing it right? On one hand, having the system's startup firmware code being firm and not hard creates a vulnerability because that means it can be altered. On the other hand, since we appear to be unable to get it right, if it's firm, it can at least be improved when problems with it are inevitably found, as they have in this case been. So the good news is there are people who are focused upon improving the situation with firmware. At the beginning of last month, a group of researchers from the firmware protection company Binarly discovered a raft of critical vulnerabilities in the so-called inside H2O, and that's INSYDE, inside H2O UEFI firmware. It is a cross-vendor firmware used by many computer vendors, including Fujitsu, Intel, AMD, Lenovo, Dell, Asus, HP, Siemens, Microsoft, and Acer. So, like, right, that's like, who doesn't use them? And actually, I think that's a good that's a good thing. Binary found 23 flaws in this inside H2O UEFI firmware kit, essentially, most of them occurring in the software's system management mode code, which provides the system-wide functions such as power management and hardware control. Since the system management mode privileges inherently exceed those of the OS kernel, which it is responsible for booting, any security issues there can have severe consequences for the vulnerable system. The flaws that were found in this inside H2O firmware can collectively and, you know, individually be used to invalidate many hardware security features, including Secure Boot and Intel's Boot Guard, to install permanent and persistent software that cannot be easily erased, and to create backdoors and back-channel communications to steal sensitive data. You know, as we've talked about this whole, this baseboard processing now, there's a whole processor separate from the Intel chip that we stick in a socket when we decide, you know, which model that we want, that runs the motherboard and all of its things. And it's very capable. So as I said, there were 23 flaws found, with three of them obtaining CVSS scores of 9.8. So this is in the baseband processing firmware. Binary's disclosure report explained that the root cause of the problem was found in, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the reference code associated with inside H2O's firmware framework. In other words, as we've seen before in other contexts, all the manufacturers derived their own firmware from inside's firmware SDK reference code to develop their customized UEFI firmware. And, you know, that's certainly reasonable. They bought a license to do so. That's what they did. No reason to recreate the wheel. The chances are when you do, you're going to make mistakes. So that's great. And so, frankly, I'd rather have everyone working from a common code base than each rolling their own, since getting this exactly right is crucially important. And when it's fixed for one, it's fixed for all. Inside Software has released firmware updates to fix all the security vulnerabilities that were identified by Binary, and they published detailed bulletins to assign severity and descriptions for each flaw. So all of the people using their kit, hopefully there are engineers right now that have been like going, you know, working through this and working to update the firmware across all their products. Of course, we always have the problem of, you know, this in the inside UEFI stuff having been around for a long time and products going out of support and no longer receiving firmware updates. It's, you know, it's difficult to require everybody to support everything forever. So they're, you know, these are really bad and now they're becoming known. So being individually customized firmware on a per product and per manufacturer basis, they all have to be created, adopted, incorporated, you know, downloaded, installed. Every single vendor needs to do this. And that way it's a little bit like the log4j mess where, you know, it is something core to many different products and publishers. So this is why I said at the top, we can expect to see important firmware updates coming from many of our hardware vendors. And I'm not suggesting that this will be a widespread attack or that will result. It's very likely that these would be used. You know, these are going to be sophisticated, targeted attacks. You need to get onto the system first. Then these are being used to achieve persistence, you know, getting down into the firmware. So I did not look in detail to see what three of these things had a 9.8, but it is possible that this could be exploited remotely because there is now management technology in some of these motherboards, which allows, you know, remote over the network management of them. So that may be why they're at 9.8. Still, it just makes sense to keep your firmware updated. And then in addition to this, on top of these 23 problems, last week HP disclosed an additional 16 high-impact UEFI firmware vulnerabilities that Binary had found, which affect multiple HP models. And HP is, you know, a user of Inside also. And that included laptops, desktop computers, point-of-sale systems, and edge computing tools. These flaws allow malware to survive hard drive replacement and operating system reinstallation. So anyway, a long time ago, we talked about how rootkits are able to hide in plain sight by doing something as simple as hooking an operating system's directory listing API to simply remove references to any of its own files from the list. You know, so you do a dir. Or any of your programs do a dir, and they don't see any of the files that are sitting in the directory right in front of them. I remember it was the Sony rootkit that we talked about way long time ago. And it's just unnerving just to imagine that something that simple, you know, I mean, it shows how much we assume that our operating system is doing what we expect and what it should, where in fact, as I said, because software is infinitely flexible, it's so easy for it not to be working the way we want it to. So anyway, keep an eye on firmware updates, and a huge thanks to Binary for digging in, to taking the time to dig into Inside's UEFI offerings and help make our stuff better.
This seems like UEFI would be a really good vector for attacks because it's basically a mini operating system that runs before your system. So, yep. And it's persistent, as you pointed out.
It has a file system.
Yeah. It can do anything. Yeah. It's Turing complete. I mean, it's a C. It's written in C, and it's basically, if I were going to be a bad guy, that would be the best place to put malware because it would survive reinstall and everything. It wouldn't survive. It usually lives on the hard drive, right? It would not survive a complete nuke of the hard drive.
No, it's in the firmware. Yes.
There's a UEFI partition though on the drive that also contains code.
Yes, and so that could be a problem, although these guys specifically said this would survive a hard drive replacement.
Oh, all right. So it is in the firmware. Wow. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what Leo they do want is
they want to know about the canary.
Out.
I know what they want.
I know
this
they
is
do.
It. This is it. This is the thing you need for ultimate security of your network. You need a honeypot. I think we've talked about honeypots on the show practically since day one. I think it was day two that we talked about the honey monkeys. The idea that you could put something on your network that doesn't look vulnerable, looks valuable, looks like something a bad guy might want to attack, except it is not what it appears to be. Now, it's a pretty sophisticated thing to create a honeypot on your own. But look at this little appliance. You can just, it's got a little Ethernet jack. You just plug it into the network. And now this device can look like almost anything to an attacker. Mine's set up to look like a Synology NAS, which means it has the login page exactly right. It has the MAC address that would be a Synology MAC address. In no way is it in any way distinguishable from a real Synology NAS. It could be a Windows server, a Linux server. It could be a SCADA device. It could be almost anything. You could put it on the you could put it on your directory so that, you know, your Active Directory so that people, when they're searching, you know, look, here's the problem. Bad guys get on your network. And they don't announce, here I am. They don't set off ransomware that day. They hang out. They browse around. We see this more and more now. Just happened to NVIDIA. Yeah, they got the ransomware, but they also downloaded terabytes of data first. They browse around, they look for weak points, they look for where you back up data so they can make sure that gets encrypted by the ransomware too. On average, bad guys hang around in the network for 191 days before they're detected. That's more than 6 months. More than 6 months that your network has been penetrated and you don't know it. That's why you need something like this. This is an early warning system. It's well named. It's a canary. It's your canary in the coal mine. So when the bad guys get on the network, they're looking for things like documents they can exfiltrate. You know, they want payroll information. They're looking at file servers, file shares. They'll try default passwords against network devices and web services. They'll scan for open services on the network. They're going to find the canary, but they're not going to know it's a canary. It could be a router. It could be a switch. It could pretend to be a Linux box. You can light it up like a Christmas tree, turn on all the services, or be a little canny, only turn on a couple of services, right? The minute an attacker attacks, the canary lets you know, and you know somebody's in the system. Boom. In fact, you can even create with this little files, they call them canary tokens, that you could sprinkle around the system, PDFs and document files. I have some PDFs. I have some XLS files, some spreadsheet files that say things like employee payroll information, things like that. They look valuable. But as soon as they double-click them, they try to open them, download them, touch them in any way, boom. I'm going to get a notification. And the canaries are great. They'll notify you in any way you want. By the way, you get an actionable alert. You don't get 1,000 alerts. You get an actionable alert email, text message you can set up. You get a console when you get your canaries. You can use Slack. It supports webhooks, so it supports anything that supports webhooks. Syslog, it supports. There's an API if you want to write your own custom software. So you can find, you know, you'll get notified however works best for your workflow. Canary was created by some interesting people. people who've made their business training companies and militaries and governments how to break into networks. And they've taken the knowledge, the experience they have, and they've put it in the canary. You'll find the canaries deployed all over the world. It's really, all security is layered. There's no one silver bullet. We know that. But boy, if you don't have this, this is real intrusion detection. And very affordable. I'll give you an example. Go to canary.tools/twit. If you wanted 5 canaries. Now, some banks will have hundreds. Big networks might have thousands. You might have a half dozen. If you wanted, let's say, 5 canaries, $7,500 per year, you get your own hosted console, you get upgrades, you get support, you get maintenance for that whole year. You sit on your canary, you break it, you step on it, it gets melted, whatever. They'll send you a new one. That's part of the deal. And actually, I'm going to make you an even better deal. If you use the word TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, you get 10% off that price forever, for life. And of course, I understand. I mean, you don't know these guys. So they offer a very good 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund, 60 days, plenty of time to try it, you know, see what happens. This thing is awesome. Everybody should have canaries on their network. Canary.tools/twit. If you want to know more about people who use canaries and love them, they've collated a bunch of tweets from people at canary.tools/love. But if you're ready to buy, canary.tools/twit. Don't forget the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. 10% off for the life of your canaries. Canary.tools/twit. This is peace of mind. This is such a great idea. We thank them for their ongoing, long-time support of Security Now. They're big believers. Back to Steve.
So, NVIDIA suffered a serious network breach last month. The hacker extortion group by the name of Lapsus, LAPSUS, then with an extra dollar sign appended to the end, claims to have exfiltrated, and all evidence is they probably did, about a terabyte of NVIDIA's very proprietary data during the attack. They extorted them. NVIDIA said, go away. So they began leaking NVIDIA's data online, as I said, after NVIDIA refused to negotiate. On February 23rd, emails and NTLM, you know, NTLM manager, you know, Windows password hashes for 71,335 NVIDIA employees were leaked on the internet. Now, this was a bit puzzling since NVIDIA currently has only 18,975 employees. But the hackers claim to have had deep total access to NVIDIA's system, where they said they roamed around for about a week. And so the presumption has been that the leaked credentials include, you know, deep past employee files as well, which would explain the high count. Then 4 days later, on February 27th, that hacking group, Lapsus, claimed it had been, you know, digging around for a week and for some reason made a point of clearly stating that they are not state-sponsored and that they are, quote, not into politics at all, in caps on the at all. So, you know, such is the world we're in today. Troy Hunt's Have I Been Pwned site now has the leaked data and noted that many of the hashes are being cracked and circulating within the hacking community. So I'm sure that NVIDIA is, you know, has already, you know, made sure that all their employees have changed their passwords, because otherwise that would even be worse. Lapsus also stole, I mean, apparently they just got everything. Think about it. I mean, we just glibly talk about a terabyte here, a terabyte there, but that is a trillion bytes, 1,000 billion bytes of data. So it's probably everything. And among the everything was some NVIDIA expired driver signing certificates. And what's confusing to me is that the reports are, and they've been confirmed by, you know, many outlets, these expired driver signing certificates were immediately put to use signing malware components in order to get them past antivirus and Windows own driver signing protections. So, expired. What's not at all clear to me is why Windows would load any driver signed with an expired certificate. But apparently it's doing that. You know, code signing works differently from TLS, you know, web server certificate signing. The reason for the difference is that servers and clients, web servers and clients, are by definition always online and talking to each other. And servers are thus always able to present a certificate that's currently valid. So that's what we force them to do. But that's not the case with code, right? A driver might be signed 10 years ago, and the certificate with which it was signed will have long since expired. You know, that particular certificate. So we want drivers to be valid in the future, even if a machine is not online. You know, so there's no like online OCSP style verification. And the point is, was the certificate valid when it was signed? So that's what we did. We solved this problem by changing the requirement, the validity requirement for code signing. We require that code is signed by a certificate that is valid at the time the code was signed. But that means that we need to know when the code was signed. And that information is incorporated by requiring co-signing of the certificate by a valid certificate authority, which offers a time stamping service. So, at the time the code is signed, the signing computer obtains a certified timestamp from a time stamping service, which is all bundled in to the final signature. You know, so it's sort of like having an online notary saying, yes, here I am, I'm I'm asserting that this is the current date and time that all of this is happening. So this attests to the time that the signing was done. Now, Bleeping Computer showed the digital signatures property page of a piece of malware signed with NVIDIA's expired cert. It shows that there was no timestamp included. And in fact, you don't need to include a timestamp. It's like, that is to say, the act of signing doesn't require a timestamp. But the entity trusting the signature is supposed to require it. I mean, that's the whole point. But all I can guess is that for the sake of compatibility, Microsoft doesn't enforce timestamping for at least some uses, and some apparently includes kernel drivers, because that's what was being signed by these expired NVIDIA certificates. They've immediately been blacklisted. There are now, we will not trust anything signed with these expired certs. But boy, it took somebody using them maliciously to make that happen, which to me just seems crazy. But anyway, that seems to be what's going on. And also, on March 1st, the Lapsus Group demanded that NVIDIA open source their proprietary drivers for Windows, Mac, and Linux. I have a picture in the show notes of their ransom demand. Dated March 1st, it says, this is Lapsus talking, the bad guys, after evaluating our position and NVIDIA's, we decided to add one more requirement. We request that NVIDIA commits to, in all caps, completely open source and distribute under a FOSS license, close parens, their GPU drivers for Windows, Mac OS, and Linux from now on and forever. If this request is not met, on Friday, we will release the, and now we have in caps, complete silicon, graphics, and computer chipset files for all recent NVIDIA GPUs, including the RTX 3090 Ti and upcoming revisions, exclamation point. And they say, of course, this includes all files with extensions such as .v, .vx, and .vg, and more. And so they finish, so, NVIDIA, the choice is yours. Either, one, officially make current and all future drivers for all cards open source while keeping the Verilog and chipset trade secrets. Well, they said secret. Or not make the drivers open source, making us, right, they're being made to release the entire silicon chip files so that everyone not only knows your driver's secrets, but also your most closely guarded trade secrets for graphics and computer chipsets, too. You have until Friday. You decide.
Oh, Lord.
I know. Now, this .v, .vx, and .vg file extensions are for Verilog, which is the hardware description language, the HDL, used to model electronic systems. It's the most commonly used in the design and manufacture of integrated circuits, and it has become an industry standard, standardized as IEEE standard 1364. This means that these guys have the designs of NVIDIA's chips, which, yes, NVIDIA certainly intended to be, kept inside. While at first this seems a bit breathtaking, it's unclear what real value those would be. I mean, maybe there's proprietary stuff that could be reverse engineered out of them, but no other reputable foundry is going to make NVIDIA clone chips. You know, they'd be litigated into non-existence, for one thing. And, well, I was thinking about this, maybe Russia would, except that Russia doesn't have the process technology to make any state-of-the-art chips. They're unable to do it. So NVIDIA's designs would be of little use to them. Last year, NVIDIA also came up with a technology known as light hash rate, or LHR, which reduces the value of its GPUs for cryptocurrency mining. Their aim is to make a very powerful graphic processor, but one which would not be very good at crypto mining, in order that, you know, gamers can actually have a chance to buy some of these things rather than them all being sucked up by the crypto miners. And apparently this also annoyed the hackers, who have said they want the hash rate limiters to be removed from the chips. So, you know, my feeling is mostly this is a huge embarrassment for NVIDIA. And it is a perfect example of just how much damage can be done when all of a company's proprietary value takes electronic form, as NVIDIA's is, and thus can be downloaded, shared, and unfortunately escape from their control. Wow.
By the way, I just wanted to show you something that came up in the Discord. And did you see this in Crystal City, Virginia? Instead of telling you when it's safe to cross the street, the walk signs in Crystal City, Virginia are telling you, change your password, change your password, change your password. I have to turn on the sound. But clearly somebody got...
change password. Change.
Clearly, somebody got into the system, and instead of being malicious, they just thought they'd have some fun, which I think is great.
Yeah, I think it's actually wonderful. It's a little bit of a Rickroll.
Exactly.
I mentioned that I wanted to just give Proton Mail, which I know is a very popular email service among our listeners, a bit of a thumbs up. Last week, you know, I grumbled about Namecheap's unilateral and, I felt, questionable decision to dishonor their previous prepaid commitments to their DNS domain registrants, who were at the time given 1 week to find another DNS provider before their domain name resolution would be summarily terminated. I think Proton Mail did the right thing. Thanks to Bleeping Computer, who was able to, one of their employees is a Proton Mail user who received a notification, preemptive notification from Proton Mail that said, "Dear Proton community member, as you may have heard, MasterCard, Visa, American Express, PayPal, and numerous other financial institutions have announced that payments into and out of Russia will soon be cut off." And they said, parens, if this hasn't happened already. "This means paying for your Proton subscription with your current payment method will likely soon be impossible. While many companies have announced that they will no longer serve Russian customers, at Proton, our mission is to defend online freedom everywhere. We remain committed to serving the people of Russia for as long as possible. The present difficulties, however, may take some time to resolve. If you are a Proton subscriber, we suggest renewing your subscription or purchasing credits before all forms of payment are cut off in the coming days. We are committed to not cutting off any users in Russia for financial reasons for as long as possible during this difficult time. If you are able to use alternative payment methods, your support will ensure that we can continue to serve the Russian people in many years to come. Thank you again for supporting our mission. Best regards, the Proton team." And they also, in this, provided a list of alternative payment methods, including cryptocurrency, that could be used by Russian users to renew their subscriptions. So, you know, I thought that was, although, yes, it's a little self-serving. They're saying, hey, you know, pay in advance quickly for if you don't want services to be cut off. You know, That to me, that, you know, their heart was more in the right place than Namecheap. I'll also note, however, that separately for those based in Russia, Belarus, or Ukraine, another encrypted email provider, Tutanota, has offered to renew subscriptions free of charge for users unable to make payments in the during the current situation. So, you know, some companies are doing the right thing. Linux has been having a rough time of it lately. The last year has seen this ever more popular server and desktop operating system hit with revelations of multiple high-profile elevation of privilege vulnerabilities. There have been problems in Linux's iSCSI subsystem, in the kernel, in the extended Berkeley packet filter, and as we talked about at the time, in the policy kits, polkit pk exec component. And there have been two additional recent problems. The first bears the unfortunate name Dirty Pipe, and was discovered by a guy named Max Kellerman, who discovered mostly by accident. Well, okay, something happened by accident. His actual discovery was certainly not that. But this event was an accident. It was an important locally exploitable vulnerability, which was introduced into the Linux kernel at version 5.8. Because the exploitation of the flaw allows overwriting data in arbitrary read-only files, it could be put to some very creative and not generally beneficial use, leading to privilege escalation because unprivileged processes could be able to inject code into root processes. So in some ways, this is reminiscent of the 2016 Dirty Cow Linux vulnerability, though this one is even easier to exploit. But it does explain, although it doesn't forgive, this vulnerability's name, Dirty Pipe. So in Max's original posting, he explains how this all began. And I'll just share the beginning of this because it was lengthy. He said, it all started a year ago with a support ticket about corrupt files. A customer complained that the access logs they downloaded could not be decompressed. And indeed, there was a corrupt log file on one of the log servers. It could be decompressed, but gzip reported a CRC error. He said, I could not explain why it was corrupt, but I assumed the nightly split process had crashed and left a corrupt file behind. He says, I fixed the file's CRC manually, closed the ticket, and soon forgot about the problem. He said, months later, this happened again and yet again. Every time, the file's contents looked correct, only the CRC at the end of the file was wrong. Now, he said, with several corrupt files, I was able to dig deeper and found a surprising kind of corruption. A pattern emerged. Okay, so then Max goes on, as I said, at great length to explain how this kept nagging at him until he finally had to sit down and get to the bottom of it. After a great deal of analysis and experimentation, he finally figured out how to force the file corruption bug to occur at will. That was the key. Max wrote, quote, all bugs become shallow once they can be reproduced. And of course, that is, you know, that's any software developer's dream, is to be able to reproduce the problem. You know, as I've referred to motherboards that I've been purchasing, old motherboards off of eBay, because, you know, one of our or several of the people testing SpinRite will all have a really weird problem. And, you know, for example, just to segue for a second, we've got one motherboard which will not run SpinRite from USB. But if you copy it to the hard drive, it'll run it from there. If you copy it to a RAM disk, it'll run it from there. But it actually won't execute it from the USB drive. Nobody else has this problem, but this one particular Gigabyte motherboard has the problem. I actually found an instruction that would not execute from USB. It's insane. But anyway, as I said, if you can reproduce a problem, you can fix it. I did reproduce it, and I did fix it, even though I don't understand it. But now it works. Anyway, Max then tracked it down to the bug, which he located in the Linux kernel. He then checked Linux 5.1.0, which is the Debian Bullseye build, which had the bug. But the bug was not present in the previous Linux 4.19, Debian's Buster. Those two releases were separated. I hope you're sitting down, Leo. Those successive Linux releases were separated by 185,011 Git commits.
Wow.
Oh, baby. But using Git's various tracking tools, he was able to locate the one commit made nearly 2 years ago on May 20th of 2020, which introduced this very subtle bug into the Linux kernel. That change refactored Linux's pipe buffer code for anonymous pipe buffers, changing the way the mergeable check is done for pipes. And in doing so, introduced an extremely subtle flaw. The vulnerability has been fixed in that one in Linux 5.10.102, 5.15.25, and 5.16.1. So that was what Max found, the first of the two problems. Then two researchers at Huawei discovered a vulnerability in Linux's control groups feature, which allows attackers to escape containment, to escalate privileges, and execute arbitrary commands on a host machine. Now, Linux control groups, or C groups as they're known, allow sysadmins to allocate computing resources, such as memory, bandwidth, and such, among whatever processes might run on a system. These C groups provide fine-grained control over allocating, prioritizing, denying, managing, and monitoring system resources. This means that C groups can be a powerful tool for control and security within a system, and in fact, they're used by containers like Kubernetes. A feature known as the release agent file allows administrators to configure a release agent program that would run upon the termination of a process in the C group. That meant that attackers who were capable of writing to the release agent file could exploit it to gain full admin privileges. And Linux wasn't checking that the process setting the release agent file had admin privileges. So basically, a very simple problem, which through a chain of complex features ended up being exploitable. And all of this amounts, in this case, to a container escape, as I mentioned, for example, within a Kubernetes environment, which would provide attackers with access to other users' containers in public cloud environments. And we're not finished with Linux yet. Yesterday, another just-disclosed security flaw came to light. This one can be leveraged by a local adversary to gain elevated privileges on vulnerable systems to execute arbitrary code, escape containers, or induce a kernel panic. It's CVE 2022-25636 with a CVSS as 7.8. It impacts Linux kernel versions 5.4 through 5.6.10. It's the result of an out-of-bounds write, in other words, a buffer overrun, in the heap of the kernel's netfilter component. The flaw was discovered by a guy named Nick Gregory, who's a researcher with Capsule 8. Red Hat explained that, quote, this flaw allows a local attacker with a user account on the system to gain access to out-of-bounds memory, leading to a system crash or a privilege escalation threat. In addition to Red Hat, similar alerts have been released by the maintainers of Debian, Oracle, Linux, SUSE, and Ubuntu. Linux's NetFilter is a framework provided by the Linux kernel that enables various network-related operations like packet filtering, NAT, and port translation. The problem results from incorrect handling of hardware offloading that could be weaponized by a local attacker to cause a denial of service or possibly execute arbitrary code. The idea of hardware offloading is that there are a number of things associated with sending and receiving network packets that are very simple to do, such as calculating a packet payload's checksum. And so they're a waste of the processor's time. They're time-consuming. Like, to do a checksum, you've got to do math on every single byte that's going down the pipe and then just, you know, and just dump the sum of them there. What happens is when you have a NIC, which indicates that it's able to automatically do checksumming, then the software just skips that completely, and the NIC hardware itself plugs the proper checksum into the packet payload on its way out. So another example of things coming on the way in is packet coalescing can be done in hardware to reduce the packet count, thus reducing the per packet processing that needs to be done. So what's happened is over time, as NIC hardware, you know, network interface controller hardware, has become increasingly capable, the more and more duties have been pushed down to the hardware level to free the software from doing things that are, you know, it's a waste of its time. Anyway, Nick Gregory, who discovered the problem, explained, he said, despite being in code dealing with hardware offload, the flaw in NetFilter is reachable when targeting network devices that don't have offload functionality, for example, the local virtual interface. This can be turned into kernel, return-oriented programming, ROP, local privilege escalation, and other things without too much difficulty, as one of the values that's written out of bounds is conveniently a pointer to a net device structure. Okay, so what does this mean? Does the spate of flaws suggest that Linux is becoming rickety? No. I think it is an indication of it becoming increasingly complex. As we know, security and complexity are perpetually at odds with one another. For security, scrutiny is always a good thing. At this point, it's the only thing I think that's saving us is like people, digging into UEFI and finding problems and surfacing them and all of the bug bounties that we have, encouraging people to look closely at code. You know, we've seen that just making something open source doesn't automagically bring more security, but I really do think in the long run, it feels like the right solution and that, you know, it's going to be the approach that wins. Okay. Our web browsers and operating systems all collectively trust any security certificate, such as a brand new web server TLS certificate that's never been seen before, because it's been signed by a certificate authority that is trusted globally by collectively all of our OSs and web browsers. But the reason they trust a never-before-seen certificate is specifically and only because the signer of the certificate has promised to and demonstrated its ability to restrict its issuance of certificates or signatures on certificates to entities whose identity it has confirmed within the guidelines set up by the CA Browser Forum. Several times, during this podcast life, we've discussed instances of apparent mistakes being innocently made, flaws in certificate issuing systems which were being exploited, and also clear instances of deliberate certificate signing abuse. So everyone's a bit concerned over Russia's recent announcement of its creation of a new, unvetted, untested, and very likely rogue Russian certificate authority. However, its creation was probably inevitable because the sanctions imposed by Western companies and governments are preventing Russian web services from renewing their expiring TLS certificates, you know, in absolute good faith. They would like to, but Western certificate authorities are banned through sanctions to do business with entities inside Russia. So what are they going to do? We all know that browsers take a very dim view of websites which offer them an expired certificate as proof of their identity. So that won't work. So if web service providers whose certificates are expiring are unable to purchase certificates from traditional certificate authorities, what choice do they have? No problem. Just pick up a certificate issued by your local authoritarian regime.
Of which there are many choices.
Exactly. None of whom are trusted. Now, there's only one problem with doing that, which is that no mainstream web browser will accept any certificate randomly signed by Russia's newly minted CA. That's just not going to happen in this lifetime. Okay, well, there is an exception. Russia does have the Yandex browser based in Russia, and it will now, no surprise, work with the Russian Ministry of Digital Development issued certificates. So, Russian sites are instructing their visitors to please switch over to Yandex. But of course, there is an alternative. If someone wished to continue using Firefox or one of the several Chromium-based browsers, in theory, they could do so by adding the Russian Trusted Root CA certificate to their browser's certificate root store. But just to be clear, that's the last thing that anyone outside of Russia in the West should consider doing. Nothing would or will prevent Russian Kremlin gremlins from creating TLS certificates for any Western websites, thus allowing them to intercept, spoof, and alter such websites' network traffic. What will likely happen, and it's probably already in the works if it's not already got the seal of approval stamped on it, is that Chromium and Firefox, maybe even iOS, if you're able to install certificates into iOS, I didn't look, will specifically blacklist Russia's rogue root certificate so that no one using Firefox or Chromium browsers or a Chromium browser could be hurt after mistakenly installing it into their browser's root stores. So for those using the Yandex browser in Russia, it's a workable solution for providing continuity of services during this time, but there's no conceivable way that any of our mainstream browsers are going to trust any certificates signed by Russia's new certificate authority. Okay, now, one last thing. You may have thought that you were going to escape this week without having to listen to me harp on WordPress.
Oh, well, we tried.
No, almost made it.
Almost.
I'm about to ask you about Babaverse, Leo, but first, I do promise to at least keep this brief. And so as not to introduce any of my own well-known bias, I'm going to simply quote verbatim from just the top of Bleeping Computer's coverage of a recently released report on WordPress security. Bleeping Computer wrote, This is not me. This is them. PatchStack, a leader in WordPress security and threat intelligence, has released a white paper to present the state of WordPress security in 2021. And the report paints a dire picture. More specifically, 2021 has seen a growth of 150% in the reported vulnerabilities compared to the previous year, while 29% of the critical flaws in WordPress plugins never received a security update. This is alarming, considering that WordPress is the world's most popular content management system, used in 43.2% of all websites out there. Of all the reported flaws in 2021, only 0.58% were in WordPress Core. 0.58%. Well, that's probably one. With the rest being in themes and plugins for the platform, coming from various sources and different developers. Notably, 91.38% of these flaws are found in free plugins, whereas paid premium WordPress add-ons only accounted for 8.62% of the total, reflecting better code vetting and testing procedures. And I would argue professional coders, rather than someone saying, hey, I just created an add-on. It's free. Here you go. And I say, good luck to you.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's not in the core. It's in the it's in these plugins. And just be very, very careful, I guess, about what plugins you install.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, you know, given that the vast majority are in the free plugins, if you want something, find something that looks, you know, pay for it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Look, you know, find something from a really reputable plugin provider.
We actually had Matt Mullenweg, the creator of WordPress, on Floss Weekly last week.
Yeah,
but
cool.
I didn't mention anything to him about it.
Well, so I've been meaning for weeks, Leo, to ask you if you had continued listening to the Babaverse.
I haven't even started. I have it. I bought it, and I haven't even, you know, I'm such a backlog of books that I haven't gotten into it. And I keep thinking, oh, I'm going to press play. Well, so how many books in are you?
Well, the initial three were the trilogy.
Right.
And so we have the fourth book. And, you know, I was a little skeptical because the reviews that I read were a little mixed about it.
Huh.
Now I understand what's going on. I mean, it was a grumpy person who didn't want anything to change. Basically, the first three books are a particular set of things, a style where we're looking at like this explosion of these. And I think I mentioned before, and this is not giving anything away because this is all – it's like on the jacket cover. It's that Bob is a human intellect that was transferred to a computer to create what's known as a von Neumann probe, which by definition is a probe which goes out into space, finds a new star system, harvests the raw materials with which to build more of itself.
Oh boy.
So replicates and then sends its copies of itself off in all directions, each with the same purpose.
Possibly go wrong.
So thus the Babaverse.
Right.
We end up with a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so the original plot line of the first three jumps around among all of these different Bobs. And I think I mentioned when I talked about it before that I had a hard time keeping track of, okay, which Bob is this? And so I just gave up. I just sort of kept reading into a new chapter, and I go, okay, it's that Bob. So what's happened in book four is we focused on one particular interesting thing which has been found. Now, there's this notion in sci-fi of megastructures. An example, a well-known megastructure, is the Dyson Sphere. Right. Where a society gets so advanced to the and in fact, people who've like bothered to chart all this, they have like a nomenclature for different stages of advanced spacefaring civilizations. Well, at some particular stage, you become able to englobe your entire solar system in a Dyson sphere for the purpose of capturing the entire energy output of the sun, you know, of your local star. And, of course, this actually was the plot for our one of our very favorite pair of books that Peter Hamilton wrote, mm-hmm. Pandora's Star. At the very beginning of the book, and again, this doesn't give anything away, Dudley, an astronomer, happens to be looking in a particular direction when a star winks off. And he's like, what? Because, you know, stars don't wink off. They can have all, you know, we have a well-known star life cycle that cosmologists understand, but turning off is not something that stars do. So anyway, that was the beginning of the story, is, you know, what could cause a star to wink off? Well, its Dyson sphere was turned on is what happened. So anyway, we need to hear about our last sponsor, and then we're going to go into wax on or wax off.
Another wacky episode of Security Now. Our show today brought to you by New Relic. If you are in charge of keeping the what was the Heinlein line? The roads must roll. If you are in charge of keeping the roads rolling, you know your worst nightmare is that middle of the night call saying the roads are not rolling. Your network is down, or your software crashed, or the cloud provider has disappeared into the ether. That's the worst. But actually, it isn't. It's the second worst. It's the penultimate worst. The ultimate worst is you have no idea what's going on, and you're trying to figure it out. And it's the middle of the night. You're bleary-eyed. You got your team working on this. Your mind's racing. What could be wrong? Everybody's scrambling from tool to tool, just trying to get the information that you need to figure out what's broken so you can fix it. And you want to do all this before the CEO wakes up. That's for sure. Well, that's why you need New Relic. They call it observability. According to New Relic, only half of all organizations are implementing observability for their networks and systems. And it's clear maintaining network observability has become an issue for a lot of companies around the world and about for the people in the middle of the night. So this is the whole purpose of New Relic. They were created actually back in the Ruby on Rails days. They were originally a Ruby on Rails tool, but now they've combined 16 different monitoring products for every possible configuration. Tools you'd probably buy separately, but it's much better if they're all in one package, one software stack, one place, so you can see what's going on and fix it fast. You'll get application monitoring, APM, unified monitoring for your apps and your microservices. You'll get Kubernetes observability with Pixie. Really nice to have. How about distributed tracing? You can see all your traces without management headaches, so you can find and fix issues fast. It's very easy. You see, that's where it stopped. It didn't get through. Network performance monitoring. Stop guessing where performance issues start. Ditch data silos. You'll get a system-wide correlated view. And that's just four of the 16 tools. And most importantly, you can pinpoint issues right down to the line of code, so you know exactly not only why the problem happened, but how to fix it fast and get back to bed. And that's really what it's all about. That's why dev and ops teams at DoorDash use New Relic. GitHub uses New Relic. Epic Games uses New Relic. More than 14,000 other companies, they all use New Relic to debug and improve their software. Whether you run a cloud-native startup or a Fortune 500 company, it just takes 5 minutes to set up New Relic in your environment. And here's the best part. You can do it all free. Forever. No credit card required. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Access the entire New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free per month forever. You don't even have to give them a credit card. But you know why they do that? Because they know you're going to want more, more, more. We want more New Relic. So start free, though, at newrelic.com/securitynow. NEWRELIC.com/securitynow. You probably heard at the last conference you were at, you know, one of your colleagues said, boy, man, that New Relic saved our buns. You know, and you've heard this over and over. What have you been waiting for? NewRelic.com/securitynow. It's the kind of monitoring, the kind of observability every company should have. You should have. You shouldn't have to wake up at 3 in the morning. NewRelic.com/securitynow. We thank them so much for their support of the Security Now show. All right, let's talk wax on, wax off.
Oh, my Lord. Okay, so QWAC stands for Qualified Website Authentication Certificates.
Oh, of course.
Uh-huh. Let's have a good acronym, shall we?
Yep.
It's just something that the European Union has proposed to adopt in an amendment to Article 45 of their Framework for Digital Identity. In this case, the digital identity of websites, not people. What makes this way more interesting than watching paint dry or watching the slowly grinding wheels of bureaucracy is that the EU has been attempting to make this happen for the last 6 years, since 2016, and they still haven't given up. And after the most recent proposal by the EU, a group of 38 well-informed security and IT academics and professionals, including the EFF, co-signed an open letter to the EU, regulators, warning that the enactment of this protocol could expose internet users to cybercrime. The open letter is titled Global Website Security Ecosystem at Risk from EU Digital Identity Framework's New Website Authentication Provisions. And the group starts off by saying, Dear Honorable Member of the European Parliament, dear member of TELE Working Party, we, the undersigned, are cybersecurity researchers, advocates, and practitioners. We write to you in our individual capacities to raise grave concerns regarding certain provisions of the legislative proposal for a European Digital Identity Framework, the EIDAS revision, and their impact on security on the web. Now, the EU doesn't appear to be backing down about what they want, and we've seen what a mess can be created when something like the GDPR and its cookie regulations are imposed upon the world. So I was very interested to understand what the EU has gotten themselves up to now. They've intruded into our lives by making us agree to every website's cookie usage. So what's coming next? I spent hours working to wrap my head around this. I've read the arguments being made by both sides and all the references I could find. I did find a very strong and beautifully written explanation of the fundamental problem with what the EU wants to do, which I believe was probably, well, I know it was written at least by last July. I think it was written by Google's Ryan Sleevey. At least he had a tweet which pointed to it for more information. But again, it was written last July, and the EU still doesn't appear to get it. What the EU wants is something more than TLS certificates. They want to have their own website authentication. Essentially, the ability to bind their own array of government validation and authentication assertions to websites. So that when an EU citizen is browsing the web and goes to a website, they want the user's browser to display a top-of-page banner stating that this website uses a QWAC. I'm not kidding you. And then because they realize, I saw an example of this in one of their slides. Actually, I have the slide, although it's so tiny in the show notes, it's difficult to see. But it like comes up in a banner at the top of the page, and then it says, parens, qualified website authentication certificate. Wow. And then a list of a few privacy and security assertions and in this banner, which will have three tabs, a summary tab, an NTQAC validation tab, and a TLS validation. And there will be an I got it button to dismiss the banner notification. Please, please don't make us do this. Anyway, so what's going on here? How's this done? The website would serve some JavaScript. That is, the website the user is visiting would serve some JavaScript. You know, who knows, perhaps the same JavaScript that now makes us all agree to be cookied. This JavaScript makes a call to an external web service, which is tasked with producing a report which will be returned for display to the user. The web service first retrieves another blob known as the NTQAC from a well-known default path on the website that the user is visiting. And we've talked about well-known paths before, right? Where, you know, it's domain slash well hyphen known slash something, where a client knows to ask for something from the server. So that blob contains a number of government-provided security and other assertions about the site and a hash of the website's TLS certificate. Now, this is just a blob on a website. The web service needs to have the blob validated. So it queries an online validator in the next step to verify the authenticity of this particular NTQAC blob. It then hashes the original website's TLS certificate and compares it to the hash it expects. So that binds the TLS certificate to it. You know, presumably that's to prevent certificate forgery, such as we, you know, have mentioned earlier in this show and also in that BGP routing hack the other day. Okay, so now it knows that it's associated with a proper TLS certificate. Next, it processes this NTQAC attributes to produce a structured NTQAC validation report, and it then performs an on-the-fly validation against additional authoritative sources, which are not specified, but they're shown in the diagram of how this all works. And when all that's done, the web service returns the validated validation report to the waiting JavaScript, which then presents the banner to the EU citizen, who will have become quickly trained to click OK, I got it, just to get rid of the thing and
exactly
get on.
The problem.
Yes. You know, it's just, it's ridiculous. You know, maybe they could combine them with the OK to cookies button so you don't now have to press two things. One thing to get rid of the authentication from the government and another button to get rid of the cookies which the government has made be posted. So what do we get in return for all this industry? We get what the EU apparently wants, which is its own governmentally controlled, separate from the TLS environment and community, governmentally controlled facility for determining, controlling, and displaying various privacy and security assertions about individual websites. The EU essentially wants to add a layer of their own input, much as they have with cookies, thank you very much, into the browsing experience of all of their citizenry. There are a number of problems with this. But as I said, these problems have been patiently, carefully, articulately, and repeatedly laid out and explained for the last 6 years so far to no avail. Now, okay, one biggie should stand out to everyone right off the bat. The web has been deliberately designed as a two-party system. The user with their browser and whatever website they are visiting are the two parties. It's me and you. Now, while it's true that in today's world, this pure two-party system immediately collapses due to a website's voluntary and deliberate inclusion of third parties, which it brings in, that's the site's choice to make. And we have been carefully chronicling all web browsers moving toward ever greater and stronger isolation of any and all third parties. They're being siloed. They're being given their own caches. You know, we're all together, one big happy cookie farm. That's all going away. So that controls tracking and profiling. The larger problem to me is that So there's that. There's the fact that this essentially codifies a formal third party presence involved in presenting all of this. All, you know, this web service, whatever it is like central headquarters for tracking of every user that goes to any of these sites. But the even bigger problem that occurred to me is, what prevents a malicious website from simply displaying the same Happy News QAC banner and giving its intended victim the all clear?
Oh, man.
You know, if the system is that easily spoofed, then what's the point? I mean, the whole thing seems, you know, absolutely nuts. The only way to prevent that would be to force it into the Chrome. Much, you know, the browser UI Chrome, much as the certificate can be, you're able to view the certificate, and that's not the web page showing you that assertion. That's the browser's, you know, unalterable Chrome, you know, its UI that lets you see the certificate that it received. So, you know, the only way you could prevent casual spoofing is if the EU forced the design of the browsers to somehow display this crap. And I mean, this is very, it's been in much of what I read, it's very much compared to the EV certs, where the idea was to show some additional information that would be useful to the user. And we know what happened to that. You know, first they weren't green any longer, and then they were just gone completely from the user interface. So the EFF, in their never boring and always over the top sky is falling style, issued a press release on March 3rd. And I have the thing in the show notes, but I'm not going to bore everybody with it. We've as I imagine reading this, I'm just thinking, okay, everyone knows, you know, it's all, you know, oh my God, this is going to completely destroy all of the website and all of our security. And the, you know, experts are urging the EU to amend the revised Article 45 and so forth. But what they talk about actually in this letter is different, because they're talking about the enforcing of other certificate authorities, which is not the system that I just read. So I thought, what? Well, it turns out that wasn't explained in the slide deck that I found, of which one of those slides is in the show notes. There is an entirely different system. The reason is there are actually three different proposed ways that this system could work. And the one the EF is all steamed up about is the worst of the three, and which may be why it wasn't put in the slides. It is a proposed single certificate solution. In that solution, various governments would each have their own root certificates added to our operating systems and browser root stores, and these governments would be able to issue TLS website certificates containing all of that additional authentication information they desire. And this is, you know, the point in the podcast where in unison we all ask, What could possibly go wrong? Yes. So the Internet Society has published an Internet Impact Brief titled Mandated Browser Root Certificates in the European Union's EIDAS Regulation on the Internet. And skipping past a bunch of the intro, I'll just share three paragraphs. They said the European Commission is currently, and this is the Internet Society, like, you know, internetsociety.org. So toned down from the the EFF. They said the European Commission is currently evaluating this regulatory framework. It organized a public consultation in 2020 to collect feedback on drivers and barriers to the development and uptake of trust services and EID, you know, the electronic ID, in Europe. On this basis, the commission has proposed an amendment to the 2014 regulation to try to stimulate adoption of the framework and the availability of secure EID schemes across the internal market. Among the changes in the new proposal are provisions around QWACs that could have the effect of forcing browsers to include TSPs, those are trusted service providers in the EU's parlance, you know, we know them as certificate authorities, authorized by national governments into their root stores without guaranteeing security parity with current best practices. In other words, it would require browsers to add these CAs to the list of trusted middlemen, even if they do not meet industry standards or are recognized as a trusted party. They said, although the text of the proposal may seem uncontentious, the high-level goals have upstated technical technical consequences, which we believe are unpalatable, regardless of which option is put into practice. Then they said, for more information about our interpretation of the proposed revisions, see Annex A. And I included Annex A in the show notes, but I'm not going to go over it because basically it's what we talked about. So this ETSI's core assumption is that browsers will validate, in other words, recognize a QWAC by binding it to a TLS certificate for the domain it is intended to represent. Since TLS certificates themselves do not provide the level of authenticity EIDAS wants to achieve, for example, they might just be a domain validation, a DV certificate like Let's Encrypt produces, or like a non-EV, or might not even be organizational, OV. They say this means that QWACs must be issued according to a separate set of processes and criteria for EIDAS-compliant trust service providers. So at this point, it is very unclear what's going to happen, and I wouldn't worry about it, except that we're all now having to click on, yes, I agree about your GD cookies for every website we
visit.
So
out of control.
It is.
Does QWAC solve a problem that exists? I mean, isn't TLS sufficient?
Yeah, they don't think so. They want,
what's the problem they want to solve? I don't understand.
They want browser certificates to contain additional verified like identity-ish things, like an actual name and an actual street address and an actual, I mean, they want to tie it to identity. And so, you know, even that raises the hackles of a lot of people who are saying, wait a minute, you know, we want the web to continue to be able to offer some level of anonymity to protect people. And EU is saying, well, digital identity is important and we want to, you know, push this down into the web browser so people know, you know, more about the sites they're visiting.
Yeah, boy, I don't like this idea at all. And
I know. Yes. And they're not giving up on it.
Wow. It doesn't solve anything, and it introduces all sorts of security problems.
Yes.
It breaks things. And the worst thing I can imagine, and now more than ever this should be obvious, is to have countries have their own certificate authorities that you have to adhere to. I mean, that's just not I'm sorry, that's terrible. Plus another banner, just what we want. There are many pages now that have such long cookie banners, I literally can't ignore the banner. I have to click past it to get to the site.
It comes up like half the page is there blocking you from doing anything.
And by the way, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't they have to save a cookie to say that you've seen this banner and not show it again? Am I wrong? That's a cookie. So you can say, I don't want any cookies. You're going to see that banner forever. The whole thing is just so broken and stupid.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And, you know, on the coattails of GDPR. which has been, you know, a mess.
Well, I'm in favor of some privacy protections,
yes,
for sure. And I think GDPR, if it weren't for GDPR, there'd be none. So, okay. But the cookie thing is ridiculous, and this sounds not merely ridiculous, but actively dangerous, breaking. It's why you don't want politicians making security or technology decisions.
Well, okay, so if they wanted to do some legislation, why not require that the do not track header
there you
is,
go.
Is
hear
honored.
That. Yeah, it's
just,
not honored.
Just, yeah. Exactly. Just, you know, do some legislation and say, you know, let people say they don't want to be tracked. And if you see that, you cannot track them. And that's the law. Thank you very much. But
you,
no.
Well, that would be easy. That would be simple. Instead, we get this. I don't even... This is crazy. This is just... This is like somebody's fever dream.
And exactly what prevents other sites from spoofing it?
Yeah, that's not... That'd be easy to put that up.
Yeah. Just do a screenshot of one that you like and just show it.
Silly. silly.
I wish it were not like such a potential problem. I mean, like, it could actually happen.
Somebody in the chat room saying, and maybe this makes sense, it's about taxation. Maybe that's possible. You know, they don't want anybody evading their taxation.
Well, on that screen, there was something about VAT.
Yeah.
I think it was the one of those authentication providers was there was some VAT thing. So
interesting.
Who knows?
Huh.
Anyway.
Once again, you know, if you didn't listen to this show, you wouldn't even know about this stuff. That's why you got to listen.
Yeah, you could actually sleep at night.
Yeah. you'd dream the dream of babies. You'd be so happy.
The world has no problems. All of my computer is secure.
Everything's fine.
I can go anywhere I want. I can go anywhere I want to.
Everything's fine.
I can click any link that I see. What could possibly go wrong? Nothing.
We do this show every Tuesday right after Mac Break Weekly, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You could stop by and watch us do it live at twit.tv/live. The IRC channel is always going, but of course it's most active when there's a live show on, and that's irc.twit.tv. Members of Club Twit get their very own little clubhouse, our Discord server, which isn't just for show conversations, conversations about everything. Stacy's book club is coming up, a Paul Thurrott fireside chat. We're going to talk to Patrick Delahanty on Thursday. He's our engineer. If you're curious about the back end, he's got a great back end. All of that in the Discord server. How do you get in? Well, you join Club Twit. $7 a month gets you ad-free versions of all the shows, access to the Discord, plus, of course, the special Twit Plus feed with stuff that does not make it to the podcast, like the Untitled Linux Show and the Giz Fizz and Stacy's Book Club. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thank you very much to all of our Club Twit members for their support. Really helps us out. Steve's got a copy of this show. He's actually two unique versions of this show. He's got a 16 kilobit audio file for the very bandwidth impaired folks. Plus, Elaine Ferris's amazing transcription, so you can read along as you listen. At grc.com. While you're there, pick up a copy of SpinRite. That's Steve's bread and butter. That's what keeps the boat afloat. It's the world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. SpinRite 6 is the current version. 6.1 is in progress, in process, and you can participate in the development as well as get a free copy if you buy right now. grc.com. The website for us, for the show, we have 64 kilobit audio and we have video, is twit.tv/SN, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel dedicated to security now. That makes it easy to share if, you know, you want your boss to see something or something like that, or your co-workers or colleagues or buddies. Just send a share link from YouTube. That's a good way to do it. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast player and get it automatically every Tuesday evening as soon as it's available. If you do that, please leave us a 5-star review. Let the world know about this, the best, the one, the only security.
The original.
Now, the original. Since 2005, baby. Now in its 17th year of education. Thank you, my friend. Have a great week. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Righto.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor of Ad Astra magazine, and each week I'm joined by Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief over at space.com. in our new This Week in Space podcast. Every Friday, Tarek and I take a deep dive into the stories that define the new space age. What's NASA up to? When will Americans once again set foot on the moon? And how about those samples from the Perseverance rover? When are those coming home? What the heck has Elon Musk done now? In addition to all the latest and greatest in space exploration, we'll take an occasional look at bits of spaceflight history that you probably never heard of, and all with an eye towards having a good time along the way. Check us out in your favorite podcatcher. Security now.